18th, the year 2000, interviewing Josh Lederberg in his office at the Rockefeller University in New York City. We're going to begin this interview today. Let's start with the same place that your involvement with the space program began, with the issue of contamination.
Mm-hmm.
You've talked with several people about how you became interested in contamination, discussing Calcutta and the possibilities of nuclear radiation and things on the moon. But what did you see is at stake in these contamination arguments for scientists or for the public? Or for the national prestige, however you'd like to interpret that.
Well, I saw planetary inquiry as a very important scientific domain. All the kinds of questions that have come up and are continue to be investigated at the present time. And I didn't want to see something as foolish as generating or dropping a load of radioactive waste, which could interfere in all kinds of ways with the further pursuit of doing the science. And then a little less likely that would be revealed later on, but even dropping packages of spores, which is what a decaying organism would represent. Later expeditions recovered evidence of microbial life. You wouldn't want to be plagued with the concern that they were simply the garbage deposits of the previous expedition. But above all, I was perturbed that the whole program seemed to give no thought at all to the scientific aspects of exploration. It was all a circus for amusement. I thought this would be an emblematic way of presenting that and to try to put some piece of the program on a much sounder scientific footing, make it a serious human effort. Now, the other side was this was a moral equivalent of war, and far better for the U.S. and the Soviet Union to show their determination that there were going to be no limits in what they were willing to expend for their security, which was demonstrated even to a large degree by defense expenditures, but also by NASA, and that they each did have the technological capability to ensure mutual assured destruction. And since that was not a very credible prospect without some sort of technological demonstration, better that it be in space than it be another Hiroshima or another Nagasaki. So I saw those as mitigating aspects of what I call the circus.
Okay. Did you encounter much resistance in pushing for contamination? And if so, what kind of people who resisted that or sterilizing probes, what kind of...
Well, I was actually surprised at how much consensual support I did get. I would say that 90% of the people that I talked to, and must have been somewhat selected, but not grossly, caught on right away and were anywhere from lukewarm to warm to very enthusiastic supporters. Look at the names of the groups that we've gotten on the committees.
Mm-hmm.
I guess there were only two figures that I can recall that were quite outstanding, that were adamantly opposed to bringing this up. One was Phil Abelson, and the other was George Gaylord Simpson. Phil, I think, was so brilliantly antagonized by the entire space program that he didn't want to see anything that might seem like constructive interest in it. So he was not particularly interested in making it better. He wanted to go away altogether. Simpson was a committed, terrestrially bound paleontologist, and he generated all kinds of arguments, none of which impressed me in the slightest, why life was such an improbable event that there was no point looking for it outside the Earth. Well, might have been improbable, but here we knew that it existed. So I really couldn't see much sense to the detail of his argument. But he and Abelson did form a numerically rather small club of people who poo-pooed the entire notion. But I would say it had astonishingly positive support. I was quite startled when I got rather prompt replies back from the higher officials of the National Academy and so on.
Mm-hmm. Were NASA and the military as equally supporting, or did they have...
This was a strictly NASA matter, mm-hmm. because planetary exploration was entirely a NASA mission.
Okay.
And has remained so.
Okay. Okay. This is a little more technical, but If you can recall, what were some of the differences between the initial sterilization and quarantine programs? There were different proposals, different, you know, levels of protection.
Well, they went through a pretty systematic review, on the one hand, of trying to estimate what the microbial loads would be, what the chances of survival would be in environments like those of Mars, and then finally putting that together with what was an acceptable level of microbial contamination on the vehicle itself, so that with further attenuation generated an acceptable risk. And I don't recall what numbers we finally came down to fit into those equations, but I can tell you who would be able to provide them, and that's D. Warner North, who did a lot of the risk assessment tree work on that, and I was in touch with him not very long ago, so he's alive and kicking in California.
Okay. Initially, there was some disagreement among WestEx members about that, and I'm thinking specifically, there seemed to be a conflict between Norman Horowitz and Aaron Novick about whether you should be asking for quarantine or sterilization. And Horowitz at least voiced his opinion that discussing this problem too much might turn off the public to the space program.
Well, I forgot the latter motive to it. I know that he was probably closer to lukewarm.
Uh-huh.
I think partly is skepticism about whether there was anything to look for anyhow. He had his own prior views, and he's written them up in his book, and it's Utopian Back, so you can get his views very clearly in that direction. To this day, he thinks the matter is settled, and that we know for sure that there is no life on Mars. I try to keep a somewhat more open mind about it. I was never sure there was. People have asked me, why did I put so much energy into a program I didn't have a strong conviction? And my answer is, it was the question that was important.
Mm-hmm.
And until the question was settled, it really didn't matter what I believed the answer was. It was important to have a process in place that could provide a credible answer.
Okay. WestEx had, at one point, proposed contracting with Fort Detrick to make a detection device.
Mm-hmm.
Could you say something about how that idea originated and how it was received?
I don't remember the outcome. I recall that as I looked into the literature of decontamination and so on, it seemed to me that most of the practical work in that direction was going on there, and they were also very interested in sensors for detecting microbial activity. I think they had a lot of published information that was useful. I don't believe that they actually ever participated programmatically in the effort, but I can't be certain about that.
But would it have been a problem for the civilian NASA, for NASA as a civilian agency, to be contracting with Fort Detrick at all? Because I know partially you were trying to encourage international cooperation.
Well, I may have been naive, but I think I felt as long as this is an open effort that you go where the expertise lies, maybe it would have had those problems of credibility and so on. I tend to take people at their words.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew quite a few of the people at Detrick. A lot of people who'd been at Detrick had come to the University of Wisconsin. Its faculty department was very close into it. Ira Baldwin had been considerable figure on the advisory groups for the BW program, and that was still the offensive program in those days. He was also the Dean of Agriculture at the University of Wisconsin. And while I was less heated then, I might have been now, while I might have preferred that they were not into an offensive development program, I took them at their words. I thought they were honorable people, and they would do the best job they could in fulfilling this kind of requirement, and they were Detrick was an instrument of national policy at that time, and they didn't make national policy.
Mm-hmm. So do you happen to, you said you didn't know the outcome, do you know if NASA did contract?
I don't think they ever did contract with them, but I'm not at all certain of that.
Okay.
I've never heard it mentioned again, and I've had a lot more to do with the BW program since the late 60s. Gap of 10 years that we didn't know much about, and it's never come up, but I have no guarantee on it.
Okay. By about 1962 or so, contamination seemed to be less less of an issue that the Space Science Board was talking about all the time.
Well, it become accepted. It become formalized in international treaty and so forth.
Okay.
The CTEX agreement.
Right.
It didn't spell it out chapter and verse, but there was a formal agreement of mutual consultation and take great care. So it was acknowledged at the international level. Now, how far that was going to be implemented, we were very curious to know what the Russians' attitudes were. Were they serious about it, and so on. Mm-hmm. I'm sure some were, some weren't.
Okay.
Same is true on our side.
Right. Okay. So now I have a few more general questions about kind of the Space Science Board, and a phrase that you used earlier, actually, which is sound scientific programs. And you mentioned that the whole enterprise seemed in some ways like a circus.
It still is.
And it's still a circus. What did you have in mind for a sound scientific program, if there was a way that space exploration could be?
Well, for one thing, much more emphasis on the planets rather than sending people to the moon, than sending people anywhere for that matter. Mm-hmm. Now, some science gets done in support of manned space travel.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't argue with that once we're, if the decision is made and settled that you're going to be putting people up there. I don't want to put them at risk. I don't want to put the country at risk by that failing. So that needed some scientific support as well. I just personally didn't have any great interest in having anything to do with it. So that's the bioastronautics side of it. But, you know, some good people did good work and trying to understand the space environment and what it would do to people and what would need it for life support. But, well, I was eager that whatever was done be on a sound scientific basis. I would have preferred a much more vigorous scientific program that would have involved more sampling of material. I know qualms about return sample of moon material, and we can still use more of that in a more systematic role today. We don't need people for it particularly, but it'll probably be done with people who have an excuse for why you're sending them there. But then even more so when it comes to exploration of the planets, the planetary exploration on the one hand, and then astronomical inquiry. So the Hubble Observatory is a magnificent scientific accomplishment by every account.
What did you see as biology's role among space science as compared to, say...
I couldn't see much besides meteorites, comets, and planets. I mean, it would be, at minimum, better evidence about what primordial organic chemical synthesis would look like.
Mm-hmm.
I got onto the other side of a, I won't call it a controversy, but a different line of interpretation with Urey and Miller, who saw the original organic molecules that were precursors to life originating by the action of ultraviolet light on a primitive terrestrial atmosphere. I saw an expanding universe, cycles of star formation, heavy element formation, supernova, re-expulsion, developing an interstellar plasma that contained mostly hydrogen, a little bit of helium, and then down to trace amounts of oxygen, nitrogen, phosphorus, and sulfur, the critical elements. You don't need a synthetic paradigm. The fact that these begin as isolated atoms, when they collide with one another, you've got organic chemistry in space going on a cosmic scale. And I thought we ought to look there for what the origins of organic molecular material. The only question is how do you get it from space to the surface of the Earth. That's still an ongoing issue, but there is cometary infall, there is meteoritic infall, and the pendulum's been oscillating from one extreme to the other about how much of the organic molecular burden on Earth could have come from external sources. And I think it's moving back again towards some credibility that quite a large component could well be accounted for that way, rather than atmospheric sources once the Earth's atmosphere has become established. So you might call this cosmic versus terrestrial origin of organic molecules. Well, exploring those contingencies, I thought and think, is still a very important arena for NASA to be interested in. And now there's been microwave studies of organic molecules in space, and as our methodology gets better and better, more and more complex molecules are being found by that spectroscopic route. I don't think it's controversial anymore. I think the and you have things like comets as reminders of those sorts of aggregates. How to get the organic molecular material on a comet, basically it's an issue of absorbing its gravitational energy without burning up everything that's in it. but some of it plainly does get through. If you get a meteorite hitting Earth that you think came from Mars, then you can get cometary material with similar material. So there's still a lot of open issues.
Right. Some of the early proposed experiments, just I was really struck by their confidence. For instance, in the design of the, I think it was called the multivator, with the phosphatase.
Well, that was out of my lab.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Well, we wanted a uniform platform in which we could plug in a variety of different kinds of experiments. So that's the multi-part of multivator.
Right. Scientifically, would something for those assays to work? Would that require whatever macromolecules that have been out there to be
in the same? Well, it depends what you choose. Actually, the problem would be more, there is phosphatase activity in quite simple species. And as I reflect on it further, in an effort to try to choose the least unlikely substrate targets, we may have been laying ourselves open to a dilemma on the other side. You can get some phosphatase activity out of inorganic salts. So take a choice. But where are you going to draw the line? If you had to make a choice, if you stuck to DNAase, which might be a preferred assay to answer certain questions, it better be the right question.
Right.
If it's a different polymer, you might miss an elephant.
Right. Exactly.
So it's a very serious dilemma to know what degree of specificity to be looking for. So phosphatase was one of the choices, precisely because they're going to be many more phosphate substrates that the phosphatases we know can handle at some rate or another, then they're going to be something as particular as deoxynucleotide polymers, which would be a wonderful signal to get, but what are the odds that it's the same kind of polymer?
Mm-hmm.
So you have all those trade-offs.
Mm-hmm. Did the multivator actually go up in
there? No, we didn't choose that particular. Conceptual analogs of it were the other experiments.
Right.
But the experiments that are actually flown, I don't believe there was any single specific enzyme assay. There was a pretty broad metabolism assay in which labeled substrates were provided, and if any of them decomposed, you'd be able to read the radioactive CO2 coming off. There again, we didn't give enough attention to inorganic artifacts that, in retrospect, certainly did cloud that issue. And the other was a CO2 fixation experiment.
Mm-hmm.
So we assume that's more likely to be a near universal. Whether they're colored green or not is another story, but there's a reason it's green. So.
Right. you had resisted, in some more administrative matters, you had strongly resisted combining the exobiology committees and the man in space committees. Do you recall with that?
Well, I thought they were a totally different agenda, and I didn't want to be giving political support to the man in space program. I wanted us to stand on our own feet and let them do the same. I also thought the talent involved was totally different. So I could see one's physiology, the other is molecular biochemistry.
Right. Was opposition to the man in space program fairly common?
It's hard to say. I don't know many working scientists who were enthusiastic for it. I think some people bought it as part of a broader political agenda. There was a small kernel of real space enthusiasts. I think Carl Sagan was probably pretty plus on it. I think he thought it would excite the public, and he was enough of a cowboy himself. He wanted to be part of it.
Mm-hmm.
So it covered a fairly broad spectrum. There's also a lot of opposition. Actually, there's a very interesting reprise. I'm going to try and get this out for you. I'm sure there have been more objective surveys on this and what people of varying degrees of education and professional interest. I don't recall them per se, but but it covered a pretty broad spectrum, and the non-scientific motives did appeal to some number of scientists, as they're human beings in other aspects too. I think there was a lot of concern about draining budgets away. I also have to say NASA went over backwards to try to win this interest and support of the academic community. It had a lot of very broadly conceived university centers programs and so on. And Jim Webb was all for using spillover from NASA to improve university academic facilities and so on. So it had some constructive aspect as part of a political agenda. You know, for 10 years this was Jack Kennedy's dream, and I think his charisma caught up with a number of people. A lot of, likewise, you might say the anti-charisma of Sputnik. We have to do something to show we're up to that challenge. So the very complexly interwoven motives.
Okay.
I didn't think we needed men in space. I thought we could accomplish the political objectives equally well, but that's, what do I know about the political motif? But I did struggle pretty hard to try to get alternative agendas on the table.
Mm-hmm. Well, considering this political, what we needed to accomplish in space, I mean, in several cases you mentioned the need for international cooperation and that you really wanted to encourage kind of scientific cooperation in space. What did you see as possible?
Well, if we're going to do planetary inquiry, first of all, I didn't want the competitive spirit to override the cautionary aspects of it. Not only with respect to contamination, I wanted the missions to work, and I didn't want there to be such heat about let's get there before the Russians do, that we cut corners in the process, and then the vice versa. So, total common sense in that regard. I also felt, no, not the scientists, the new scientists. And I thought it was also a place where, and it was indeed the case, you could have Russian physicists and American physicists talking to each other, and just incidentally that, you know, trying to work over other technical contributions to solutions of arms control programs, things of that sort. I'm sure Jerry Wiesner was very deeply imbued with that. He was science advisor to Johnson. But when I would bring up with him, the manned program basically said, you're wasting your time, the decision's been made, and I did my best. I didn't disagree with the judge, but I got to follow what the boss says. The decision's settled, so why don't you just go along with it?
Mm-hmm. How did you end your involvement with the SSB?
I don't recall. Is it still in existence? I mean, I think I sat in it for any number of terms, and the structure's changed a bit.
I was really struck by, in 1962, there was a change in leadership, and the NAS Sites came in instead of Bronk, and I think Hess became the new chair of the SSB instead of Bergner. But it seemed like that there was a changing of the guard, and a lot of people were sent letters that, from a perspective looking at it now, it's kind of ambiguous of whether all of you had felt you had spent your time or if they wanted a different crew.
I had no problem with it. I spent my time.
Oh, okay.
And I didn't lack for influence if I needed it. So.
Okay.
I certainly at no point felt abused or left out, and I was on any number of direct NASA committees and so on.
Mm-hmm.
I had more than my fill.
I'm sure.
That wasn't an issue, and I was an active participant in the Viking project. So.
Right. Okay. Besides the Space Science Board, I have a list of some of the other early federal advisory boards that you served on, including, you know, the Kennedy Health Team and doing some.
Can you hang on a minute?
Yes. Okay. So. Of the other advisory boards that you were serving on in kind of these years right after you went to Stanford, immediately after the Nobel Prize, including the Kennedy Health Team and later in the 70s, kind of the National Mental Health Council and various others, any that you find are important, which ones did you feel like were the most important of all of your early committee and federal policy work?
Well, it varies with epoch. Um, That episode I told you about 1950 in the Genetic Society, I think was my first venture into political territory. It was pretty early in my career, actually, and I was astonished. Here I was 25 years old. I was 3 years into my first academic job, and I was being, put up against Mueller on a genetic society committee. But I guess I had spoken eloquently enough, and so on, that I had persuaded a number of people that that mine was closer to the voice of reason. It was somewhat painful for me to do that. I so deeply admired Mueller, and he'd been so kind to me personally, so there was no personal rancor of any kind, not even remotely so. He had a little buzz on this particular matter. Then, I guess I'm answering a somewhat broader question, but I see if I can get a reasonable chronological framework. In the mid-50s, I began to be missing my medical roots. I'd made a wrenching decision about not finishing medical school. I'd completed a PhD, sort of ex post facto, my work at Yale with Ed Tatum. Is this familiar to you?
That part about the math, right.
And then took a job as an alternative to going back and getting my MD. At Columbia, took a job, which was a wise choice, at Wisconsin, in the genetics department, but it was a school of agriculture. There was no genetics in that or any other medical school at that time. So as I settled in at Wisconsin, got my lab going, got my teaching going, and so on, and the opportunities for being part of a medical research enterprise were expanding as the field was growing, I then certain sense got to be a little bit more political or policy oriented by moving towards the ensconcement of genetics in the medical curriculum and actually getting it organized as a self-standing department. And that was, I think, pretty much of an innovation in schools at that time. So that's 1955-56. That coincided with the arrival at Madison of John Bowers as the new dean. He'd been running some of the major radiobiology programs of AEC up to that time, so he was a beagle radiobiologist by background, biological effects of radiation. But this fit in with his plans for what he wanted to see in scientific development in medical school. So it sort of happened against the great majority vote of the medical faculty. And we had scrounged around looking for the money for it and so on, but it looked like it was going to be settled. Anyhow, that was sort of one of the first major policy issues, and I got to be head of a mini department, recruiting people and so on, so extra laboratory commitment. So that was the next. Ended up being a little restless with the somewhat limited horizons at Wisconsin, particularly in the medical direction. And the brand new medical school at Stanford, Art Kornberg beckoning, going out there himself and so on, decided to go out there and had called it a misfortune. Just as we were packing up to leave from Madison, the Nobel Prize comes in. Not good timing. it just doubled the kind of gritty feelings about turning my back to my friends, going somewhere else. People getting it all mixed up, saying Stanford has recruited another Nobel Prize winner. Mm-hmm. And so, sort of nobody being able to take legitimate credit for any part of it.
Mm-hmm.
Anyhow, there it was. And so there's no doubt a lot of the public attention that I got after 1958 was connected with the prize. But remember the stuff, the fuss I made about planetary quarantine and so on, that was before the prize announcement. With the prize, but there's no question that it's added to the automatic credentials. And I suspect that when I was introduced to the Kennedys and asked to serve on the health team that did have something to do with it, that I represented scientific medicine on the health team. I guess I was the person to do that. So there's a kind of self-fulfilling aspect of that. You get more experience. Hopefully you did a good job. You'd be noticed for other such opportunities and so on. And you start paying more attention. I felt I needed to enhance my policy education. And can't accurately describe how I did that, but I would pay close attention to seminars in sociology, history, political science, economics, and so on. It's not that my reading in those fields began at that time, but it was certainly accentuated as part of that process. I'm kind of approaching an answer to your question, but I'm trying to fill in a little more of the background. 1961, I was invited to a symposium of the SIBA Foundation on man's
right.
biological future.
Right.
And don't take offense at the word man. It meant human.
Right,
okay.
Right.
And that set me thinking for the first time a little bit more systematically about what was going to be the human impact of the new biology that I was one of the creators of, and I tried to systematize my thoughts for the paper that I gave at that time. One of my conclusions was the future was going to be richer than the past. Don't try to settle everything today. The technical environment will be totally transforming. And don't try to fix every problem today. We don't know that much diagnostically, and the therapeutic modalities will be infinitely greater. So that was my rebuttal to the eugenicists. You got a very clumsy methodology.
Mm-hmm.
You're not really sure what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
There are issues about trying to forestall, you know, this became the negative eugenics of please let's forestall deleterious mutations and try to save for malformations. I couldn't argue against it. But then that says let's focus on the individual baby. I don't want deformed babies born.
Mm-hmm.
But that's my objective rather than purifying the gene pool.
Now, was that the conference where you introduced the, well,
eugenics.
Is the word eugenics?
Yeah, exactly.
Is that where you introduced
it? That was
it?
My counter slogan.
Okay.
And in a way, it is a stalling action. Let's deal with today's phenotypes and worry about
mm-hmm.
tomorrow's genotypes tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
Muller, I guess, was not there, but read a paper. Julian Huxley stood for that movement, and he was still talking rather vehemently about the negative eugenics side. So to the extent I had a debate, it was with Huxley. That's what framed that argument. Anyhow, that got me starting to think a little bit more deeply, and I began bringing that into some of my teaching. Nobody else was talking about cloning or genetic engineering, so these are some of the very first discussions of those issues, and I to some degree got caught up in it myself. So from 61 till roughly 67, it partially overlaps when I started writing my columns. I was pretty much preoccupied with those kinds of issues. Just as the word dogma is a joke, I use the term alchemy for genetic alchemy, and both, what's his name, Krimke, yeah, at Tufts, and Jeremy Rifkin, of all things, have taken it much too seriously. They have no sense of humor whatsoever. Well, it was kind of poking a little bit of fun, but still saying there are things to be thinking about, and not wanting to keep any secrets about what was coming along. So I spent those 5 years catharsizing myself about what I really felt about those matters. And I have to say, from about 67 on, I then got kind of tired of it. I didn't feel there was that much more to be said. I was going to say the same things over and over again. So I published a few things in that genre, and then said that was my last word. So more or less is. Now I can pull out the publication that I still stand on is
mm-hmm.
being surveyed, so if you'd like that, I'll identify it for you.
That might be helpful.
Okay. Now, when it comes to more, you were asking about more public involvement, which committees and so forth.
Or which ones you felt were the most, I guess, important from a science policy perspective?
Well, certainly the Kennedy Health Transition Team. There were a few things there. There were, first of all, its specific policy recommendations in bolstering of Medicare. support for biomedical research as a built-in part of the health agenda. There was a call there, and I don't recall if it actually survived the final report to the president. It's one of the versions, but not the other, so I guess the president didn't accept it as a formal recommendation. But I called for establishing a national academy, I think it's called the National Academy of Medicine, to be a counterpart to the National Academy of Sciences, to provide the same sort of expert advice on health policy matters, so that was a process matter. Well, in one way or another, that was the precursor of the Institute of Medicine, although only a few people knew about it, and it was an idea that was revived in any number of forms. I think I can say it did have that. It was part of the history of ideas of that particular enterprise. Now, that was a pretty high leverage unit. I mean, that was reporting directly, through the chairman, but directly to the president. I decided to go into writing columns. For one thing, I just got sick and tired of travel. I was doing so much of it for NASA that between 1961 and 1965, I think I actually succeeded, 62 to 66, something like that, in not traveling cross-country at all for that interval. So that says I wasn't on any national committees, and I was fighting them off. I wanted to find other. I wanted to do my own thinking. I wanted to have other avenues of influence. And it's a complicated story, but instead I got into writing a weekly column, and that brought me up to 71. Uh-huh. And there I declined service on the President's Science Advisory Committee. I thought it would be a conflict of interest to be somebody writing all and telling all on the one hand and receiving confidential information on the other. Mm-hmm. I was probably using that as an excuse against it. But there was something to that. If I was using all the information at my disposal, which I assume a writer for the public, particularly a regular columnist, is expected to do, it'd get a little hairy if you hear things in confidence you then can't talk about. Mm-hmm. So I stayed off. It wasn't until the late 60s that I started going on. Then there were mostly not high policy matters. There were tactical things, NSF panels, NIH panels, study sections, things of that sort.
And at some point in the 70s, you became involved in...
I'm trying to remember what committee that was in.
Yeah, well, this is just kind of a fragment from one of your organization, from one of your outlines that mentioned something about national security involvement in the 70s.
Yeah,
how did you get involved in that?
Oh, yeah, no, that was the big thing. That was the big turning point in spite of my... one of the consequences, and it did have big repercussions, one of the consequences of some of the things I was writing in the column is that the direction I was taking aligned to what the Nixon administration decided it was going to do about biological weapons and arms control. Mm-hmm. And that was a separation of the BW and the CW issues. Mm-hmm. Now, the moral stance on BW was so much more compelling that a lot of my colleagues regretted my severing them because they thought they could use that as leverage to get a more comprehensive agreement. I felt the moral stance on BW was so compelling we had to get that at all costs. And I thought it would be a long time before we'd get a CW arms control agreement because it was an established weapon. It was something that had been used widely in World War I. The military weren't comfortable with it, but they knew what to do with it. They were going to squawk about giving it up. And then there were the quasi-CW going on in Vietnam, which brought in a wholly different set of controversies, which greatly clouded it. They may have been the main motive for some of the other folks. That was a way to do some Nixon bashing. But I wanted to solve the BW problem. It wasn't that I was very fond of Nixon, but I really was quite fixated on that. So I suddenly got a call from the Arms Control Agency. Would I advise them in Geneva during the negotiations and maybe speak to the Committee on Disarmament at the UN? That was a totally new level of territory for me. And I obviously hastened to say yes and was quite deeply involved in that process as a result. two or three impacts. We had a 30th anniversary of that event not long ago, the negotiation of the treaty. I had a couple of people who had been there in Geneva, came to this UN meeting and said, Dr. Lederberg, you don't realize what an impact you made with your talk. And we diplomats were trouncing around, and the picture you painted, if we didn't come to terms, was really so horrifying, it really helped us beat into shape. I didn't know that it had that deep an impact. I've had that testimony in several places. So it takes to get some credit for the actual bringing to terms of the treaty. So it's a flawed treaty, but it's the best we're ever going to get. I think it's been a very important step in delegitimating BW. It's not that it's easy to enforce it, but at least that's the status of the law at this point. So I put that tops on the list, and it's sort of right at the beginning of that sequence. Then a little bit after that, I started getting nibbles from the Defense Science Board, from other defense-oriented places, the intelligence community. And precisely because most of the academic world was boycotting those agencies at that time, I felt the moral obligation to come to terms with them. That if they didn't hear some, what I would call, voice of reason from in-house, they weren't going to get it anywhere else. And there was just going to be such mutual polarization that it would end up being much worse.
So sort of a working within the system.
Exactly. So I realize that's working with the devil, but I made that decision. And that more or less coincided with my ending my public persona in my columns. That was coming to an end anyhow. So I felt able to go into getting clearances, dealing with classified information and so on if I was no longer writing a weekly column. So I think until recently my not very visible contributions have been in the national security side, some degree of sanity and what we need by way of weapons programs, what chances we should be taking in arms control agreements and pressing for international convergence in a wide variety of areas, and I continue to do that. And I was a very lonely character for some time during the height and still ongoing, you know, raging about the Vietnam War. I never gave it any support of any kind. I would chide myself for not having been more openly and aggressively against it. People like McNamara said how totally wrong it was to have been a proponent. I will say it was wrong for me to not be more aggressively opposed to it. I didn't think it was all one-sided. I didn't think much of the benevolence of the North Vietnamese Army and the Viet Cong. They were just as imperialistic as the other side. But perfectly obvious that it would have been a better outcome for everybody if we had not supported South Vietnam, but that's now that we know the outcome. So.
Right.
And what an enormous human cost that entailed. But, what was flawed was the domino doctrine, and that I have to lay right at McCarthy's feet. It seems to be going back a few years, but he expunged every trace of expertise on East Asian and Russian politics in our State Department, our security organization. And while there undoubtedly were some people who had communist commitments, I think much more harm than good came out of it. And this is one of the proofs, is to have such a one-sided view of that dynamic. So.
Okay.
So that takes us to the early 70s and so on. Most of what I do and have done in connection with DOD is not very public, and it isn't that discreet. It's very hard to point to one single thing, but I think a lot of what's happened in those agencies would be even more insane if they didn't have a few folks like myself willing to listen and willing to talk back and willing to do it on a close-in basis. Subsequent to that, I've become more concerned about the enforcement of the BW Treaty. Now, the gross violations have shown up, and then that does involve our national security doctrine to a substantial degree, and then the bioterrorism questions that are still further manifestation of it. So And those are things that are working. Things are happening as a result of my involvement there. But in parallel, since about 15 years ago, infectious disease is a much broader agenda. I've been working mostly through the Institute of Medicine, National Academy of Sciences, the CDC, some interdepartmental government agencies, and trying to put aside the complacency about infectious disease. Now, the AIDS epidemic should have settled that once and for all, but even at that, it's amazing how few people have been able to conceptualize a generalization that if something like AIDS could come up out of the blue, so will a dozen other things, and they will, and they are. So, you know, today's concern is West Nile. So the IOM report on emerging infections has had an enormous impact. As it was 1992, it's going to go into another edition before long. And I think it has reset the national, even global agenda to some degree. I've been on WHO committees with the same objective. Sorry, such a long-winded answer, but it's not a
it's
simple
extremely
question.
Helpful. Yeah. It's actually a very helpful way for you to answer it. If we could actually move on to the columns now for a little bit. In Harriet Zuckerman's book, she quotes you as saying that you started the columns partially as a way to protect against distortion. The idea that if you spoke...
Is that in the Nobel Elite?
Yeah, that's in there.
Oh,
the idea that if you... It's either in that or perhaps it's in that one. But the idea that if you spoke for yourself, at least you would get it right.
Yeah, no, that was my immediate motive. Mostly before then with various kinds of space stuff, and they never got it right.
So what... If you could be a little specific, if you can, what kinds of experiences have you had that led you to this? Just the space stuff in this book?
Well, I don't recall. Well, there must have been some stuff about Algenae as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it certainly was.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm sorry, what the provocations were kind of faded away.
That's fine.
But I recall those attitudes, and Harriet has documented it from pretty early in the game.
Uh-huh.
She must have done that in the late 60s. Couldn't have been much later than that. When did her book come out?
I have a 10th. I think it's mid-80s. I think it's mid-80s.
No,
I don't know, maybe 79?
Oh, hold on.
Okay.
No. What's amusing is that she had solicited me for an interview when she was putting it together, and I had declined.
Mm-hmm.
And then some years later, I got to know her and Bob Merton very, very well and become fast friends. We put a couple of things together and so on. So, but I was trying to guess when that interview might have been. But I saw a great deal of her during the year they were out at Stanford in 1974.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe that was the problem.
Right.
Okay.
In large part, do you think that strategy worked?
Oh, yeah. I was able to speak with my own voice. And not just distortion, but compression. I mean, so many of the things I want to talk about are so nuanced. The interesting questions all are. That a little bit of this, a little bit of that. And
mm-hmm.
I may be very frustrating to some readers in that I tend to complicate most questions, not simplify.
Right.
And that just doesn't come across in somebody else's reporting.
Uh-huh. So did you do any TV or radio spots?
No. I've pretty much systematically defined them. Exactly the reason that I do my own column. I have script control on my column.
Right.
I have no control whatever what appears on a TV show.
How common was it for you to get requests to do, say, television interviews or radio interviews?
I'd say I get one or two a month over the years.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You know, they tend to come in clusters when there's some hot event. Lately it's been about bioterrorism, something of that sort. But and I think they've probably mostly gotten pretty tired of asking.
Mm-hmm.
I've made one or two exceptions. There was a BBC series on emerging infection where I thought they were trustworthy, and they were. That came out okay.
Mm-hmm.
There was one other. But it's just a medium I detest for communication. I think it's great for entertainment, period.
Okay. Many of the columns...
It's not accountable.
Yeah, no, it's not.
You know, somebody, if they, even if it's somebody else's reported, if they really get it wrong, they can be held to account and have to respond to a demand for a correction. You can't do that with TV.
Right. It seems to be getting worse as well. But
okay.
Okay. a lot of the columns, the content seems to have little to do with your scientific expertise. They're things, the ones say on, you know, the voting age or our involvement in Vietnam. How did you pick what you wanted to write about?
As we got to arms control, I felt that although I had entered into the field from a specialist background of a microbiologist, I spent a lot of time continuing to work those. The timing's wrong, because that only started in 1970. I was well into my college. I'm putting the cart before the horse. I was still in touch with a lot of scientists who in turn were connected with arms control. Leo Szilard, outstandingly. Mm-hmm. I'd heard a lot of the debates, so I didn't feel like I was a total dummy. I certainly felt I was the match of any of their other political columnists in dealing with those kinds of issues.
Mm-hmm.
I tried to stick to things where there was some special scientific angle, but certainly spilled over that, most notably on international security matters.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how else to answer your question. Mm-hmm. Things I ended up feeling more strongly about, and then I'd be chided now and then by the editor.
Right.
You know, we have much more high-priced columnists than you to deal with those matters.
What about other scientists? Did your colleagues seem... Did it bother your colleagues whenever you would write about non-scientific things?
No, on the contrary. I had... I thought I would get a certain amount of... Josh is trying to grab for the headlines of something of that sort, but, which was not the case. I didn't get that kind of feedback at all. If anything, it would say, you know, we're glad you're doing this for us.
Somebody has to do it.
A more general attitude. And on specific cases, what I enjoyed the most were people would say, well, you didn't get it quite right. Here's chapter and verse on the detail, and do better next time. For a columnist, you did okay. So when I could engage in more substantive discussion on things I opened up, I welcomed it. Pretty hard for me to think of anything that I got in the hot water about with my scientific colleagues.
Mm-hmm.
I think there were some other public issues, I guess abortion, and that got more angry comments than most anything else.
Mm-hmm. To your knowledge, were there many other scientists that were doing the same thing in other newspapers?
To my knowledge, nobody was doing anything quite like that in terms of a regular series.
Right.
Now, there were occasional contributions from various places, and Hal Marowitz wrote a monthly but not for the general public. That was more of a physician's audience. I guess Steve Gould probably comes as close as anybody, and there again, that's somewhat more narrowly framed.
Mm-hmm.
The National Academy has tried to encourage not single columnists, but it will syndicate a variety of pieces from various sources, so that's probably the nearest next example.
Right. I mean, one that I know of is that in about 1965, Salvador Luria organized a group of people to do a column in the Boston Globe. So for several months, someone contributed. It wasn't the same person, but
I don't even remember that.
Yeah, they were kind of similar to Man in the Future type things. They were about science and, you know, the future of mankind. But from that, I didn't know if lots of people were doing this in 65.
It's very rare. I can see it did peter out, thing that's all of it. I don't remember ever hearing about that. Is it in this book?
I've seen it at the APS.
Yeah.
They have some of his correspondence about
it.
And some of his correspondence with the editor.
It's a little surprising, because since I was later on doing similar things, I may have just totally forgotten about it.
Yeah.
It was not a long-standing enterprise.
Okay.
It's not an easy thing to do. But I'll tell you what got me in the end, where I couldn't do it indefinitely, is that I'm just much more of a scholar than a journalist. And it ended up that I have 20 cabinets full of ancillary material based on the content of the columns, you know, filling in the notes. And if I ever return to this topic again, the follow-on discussion and so on, it just got to be more than I could handle.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't forget about things I'd written about.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided it was time to bring closure to it.
Right. Right.
At one or two occasions, I was going to republish them as a collected works with some further commentary, and that's ended up being my current archival project, and I will annotate the the columns ad lib, but I'm not under any deadline to do so, so just as things come along.
I'd like to talk just a little bit about what it must have been like to be at Stanford, one of the quintessential Cold War universities during the 60s. Because of their physics labs and their electronics labs, in the historiography, that's how they've been portrayed. Perhaps it's not so much for the biological sciences, but for some of their other work. Historians of science have kind of jumped on them as kind of a model of Cold War university.
They certainly had no weapons laboratories.
Mm-hmm.
They had a major atomic energy department installation, the SLAC facility, which had absolutely nothing whatsoever to do with weapons.
Mm-hmm.
Most folks involved in it were ardent proponents of arms control, and some of the most successful, Sid Drell and Pete Panofsky. Pete was the director of SLAC at one time. SRI was an affiliate of Stanford, and it deserves most of the credit for what you're describing.
Mm-hmm.
They had innumerable contracts, including classified contracts. There was a student reaction about offing them, and they were off.
Right.
They were just disestablished, and they were totally independent activity. There was a medium-sized handful of professors who continued to have joint appointments.
Mm-hmm.
Not in physics, that would be the last place, but electrical engineering.
Right, the electronics.
They would be in things like advanced radars and so on.
Uh-huh.
But
I think it partially
has... called Stanford.
Well, I think it's getting that reputation, actually, because it's behind MIT, actually, in the amount of funding that it was getting for a large period, for, I think, throughout the 60s, because at that time, SRI was still considered part of Stanford.
Yes.
Before the student...
Well, maybe even more importantly, you had Department of Energy, which makes bombs,
uh-huh.
which also paid for all of SLAC,
uh-huh.
which has a budget probably comparable to Stanford University.
Right.
So, I mean, to do the bookkeeping that way, it may seem...
Right,
so.
I'm sure it might have. But so, in the biology...
Across the board for the whole university, you know, the mentality of its faculty and the mentality of its administration is not in any way what you'd call Cold Warish. And that's what I'm trying. Oh, there's another reason, though. The Hoover Institution.
Okay.
Yeah, that was the bastion of the Cold War warrior side.
Okay.
Okay. They were all in one place. They were all in one building.
Quarantined away from the rest of you.
Well, they were, yes. They were regarded as pariahs by most of the faculty.
Okay. So you said you tried to avoid kind of classified and clearance and Department of Defense things while you were writing your columns. Did you have much interaction with, did you have any defense contracts or even for any of the information sciences material you were working on?
Oh, yeah, we had DARPA support for work in artificial intelligence,
uh-huh.
which had no military justification whatsoever. It was why it was eventually terminated.
Right.
And there were quite a few. DARPA was inventing the Internet, and 80% of what it was supporting arguably be said to fed into that development. So that was the great Cold War contribution that made.
Right. Did you ever see yourself as either a Cold War or an anti-Cold War scientist?
Well, I didn't. I thought those are simplistic classifications.
Of course.
I'm sure you know that would be the answer. I'd had a jolting experience in 1962 during the Cuban Missile Crisis. And it's paradoxical because I shrugged it off. And Leo Szilard had called me. And this is in Lanouette's book about Szilard, by the way.
Okay.
And said, Josh, where do you think we ought to go? And I knew what he was talking about. Said, I'm not going to go anywhere. Nothing's going to happen here.
Uh-huh.
And if it does, there's no place to hide. I was much more naive then than I am now about how things can go wrong during times of crisis. It was my reflections that I had been unduly complacent about the matter that, you know, over the few years following, you know, maybe take stock. I did take the hazard of things getting out of control quite seriously. I also thought that There was a lot of game playing going on, but they were playing with fire. I knew that we had to engage in measures to lower those risks, to temper it. I didn't think the numbers of weapons, per se, were the most critical concern, because they were set just on the overkill. If we've got 100 times more weapons, it would kill us all anyhow. What difference does it make,
maybe
that level?
And
I thought rather of trying to get institutional frameworks that would lessen the likelihood that any of them would ever be used. And here I was a little bit at odds with the other arms controllers, because that to me meant, let's slow down the rate of technological innovation. Let's go in for test bans as one means of controlling that. And then maybe they'll give us enough time to work out what we're going to do. If the technology is changing every 5 years, and that's what was happening, it just takes the ground from under your feet as you try to work out new agreements. So a little bit quizzical about numerical arms control. Not that I wouldn't have liked to have it happen, but everything was going into that. And I felt it might even have the paradoxical consequence that if all the hard bargaining was going over how many silos have you got and how many launching platforms have you got, they would be given a value beyond their real value, because they become part of the bargaining chips and so forth. So that was one of the complications. Getting more discourse between the military, techno-military, and political leaders was, seemed to me, very important. What did we really have to argue about? Taking more positive attitudes, trying to find confidence-building ways of reassuring the Russians that we were not going to hurt them, that we contained what was necessary. We didn't want them to spread further over Europe. That was kind of the ideology that I was trying to promote there.
Mm-hmm.
So it was kind of a middle ground. I mean, it was not an automatic condemnation of the Defense Department. I was very grateful we had a plausible deterrent. I didn't think enough of the stability of the Russian regime to think that we could safely leave matters only in their hands. I didn't think we could leave matters safely in the hands of our own leaders. So a balance of terror was the best we could do during that interval.
Mm-hmm.
Does that answer your question?
That does answer my question. That's helpful.
But it had to be modulated by common sense and by some sense of what's going on, and especially trying to guess how could this thing go wrong? How could it end up with catastrophic consequences? So things like being sure that there were protective action links that would control the launch of missiles from forward positions, being sure that there were regimes of crisis stability as against instability. I thought that was the most important intellectual contribution of the Cold Warrior academic complexes,
mm-hmm.
Working that through in some detail, that would give you the latitude of waiting to see whether something is really coming in on you, never be in a position where you feel use it or lose it.
Mm-hmm.
And those are grossly destabilizing matters. And well, in 62, I shrugged off the idea that it would ever be brought to the point that anybody could ever dream of launching. I didn't disabuse of that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Yeah. You briefly mentioned earlier the student protests against the classified research at
mm-hmm.
Stanford. So I think on April, the main one at Stanford, I think, was on April 3rd, 1969, but in March 4th, there was another big student, grad student, and faculty strike. Did you participate in any of those?
No, I participated. I spoke at the name of the amphitheater, picturesque name, but Dick Lyman had asked me to do that, in which I said, don't be taken in by, don't be co-opted by violent radical action.
Mm-hmm.
They're trying to get you to do things that will get you beaten up, so you'll be forever co-opted.
Mm-hmm.
Use your own heads and get out the vote. If you want to change policy in Washington, your marching in the streets isn't going to do it. Getting the
mm-hmm.
vote out will.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the position.
Okay. I think somewhere it says later you did some teach-ins against biological weapons.
Yes, that was, I didn't think there was that much going on at Stanford that
uh-huh.
we weren't teaching in against local programs.
Right.
But that's part of a public education issue and trying to put some pressure on Nixon to not use chemical weapons, which I think at some point he might have been tempted to do. I don't think BW utilization was a live matter, but didn't need, sorry about the pun, but that was always also a contingency.
Okay.
But I was not an activist trying to lead the students on. I was trying to get them, lead them into more responsible roles and using the electoral process.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, that actually covers, I think, all the prepared areas that I wanted to touch on. Are there any other elements of your kind of public persona that you'd like to address or bring
well,
up?
Well, it's inexhaustible.
Well, I'm sure it is.
I mean, it's all out there in the
of course.
In the profile, so I'll just throw that back to you.
Okay, well, I thank you for your time.
Okay.